Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 7 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we dissected Diego Simeone's definitive shift in style. We put Le Havre's prestigious youth academy under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We unpacked the most recent edition of Der Klassiker and we explained Juve's humble efficiency. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, Rory Bartlow has probably just about recovered from a day showing the infamous Slaney, the sights of Madrid. Bartlow was, of course, pitch side with Slaney for Atletico Madrid's 6-0 win against Celtic. Well, I say pitch side for the warm-ups and then took his seat. Very fancy looking seats, it has to be said as well. So yeah, Bartlow, how was your day with Slaney? And yeah, how have you been doing generally?
Yeah, it was dynamite, it has to be said. I mean, Slaney, to be fair to him, great guy. He was dead on with me, at least. And had a really good time. I basically kind of showed him around kind of some of the tourist sites of Madrid. So it's something that I've done quite a few times for my pals. And to be fair to Slaney, he made it not too different from that. So yeah, it was great. And then the game was pretty incredible to be kind of pitch side. I mean, you obviously have been to the Metropolitan quite a few times now, but you kind of lose some of that perspective when you're kind of right there, down on the ground, and you can look up and around at the sights around you. And also seeing the players that close up as well is also something pretty special, especially when they're in such brilliant form as Atleti were when they demolished Celtic 6-0.
Yeah, Barlow, I did appreciate Slaney's optimism going into the game, but yeah, I think I wasn't too surprised when Atletico did win and win in such convincing fashion. But I will actually ask you before we get into the nuts and bolts of the European football that we love to cover, what I will ask you, Barlow, is who was a more difficult customer as a tourist in Madrid, James Williamson or Slaney?
Oh, no doubt, Jimmy. That guy never stops moaning. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I'll say this for James. He can row a boat better than Slaney can.
Yeah, and his Spanish can't be too much worse than Slaney's valiant attempts. Anyway, enough on that. If you've not seen the video already, it's a cracking clip. Go and check it out on the Open Goal YouTube channel. Barlow makes a stellar appearance, shall we say, and it's well worth your time. So do go and check that out. But I think now, Barlow, we'll turn our attention away from that magnificent day that you had last Wednesday and we'll turn our attention now to a club in the north of France.
Yes, now, no excuses for this. Le Havre, that's my best pronunciation attempt and nobody can have a go at me. I think that was quite good. Are back in the top flight for the first time since 2009 and many expected the Normandy club to struggle, but a third of the way now into the season, Luca Elsner's side are now more than managing to keep their head above water. So, with the club currently sitting seventh in the table, what have been the main takeaways from their opening 12 fixtures of the campaign, Ali?
Yeah, Barlow, I, for one, am delighted that we are finally getting the opportunity to cover Le Havre on the Road to Nowhere podcast. Now, they were obviously promoted to the top flight this season and I've been pleasantly surprised at how well they've adapted to life in Ligue 1. So last season, even in winning Ligue 2, they did struggle for goals and they actually scored fewer goals than all but one of the eight teams directly below them in the table. And then to add to all of that, over the summer, they lost Quentin Cornet and their talisman Victor Lekal, who were two of their three joint top scorers last season with six goals each. I think that in itself tells you quite a lot that the highest scorer in the team only scored six goals. He then had Amir Richardson, who was another starter who returned to Reims following his successful loan spell. And just for some bonus trivia, actually, Richardson is actually the son of the American former NBA player Michael Ray Richardson. So there you are, a little bit of trivia for you. Love a bit of trivia on the podcast. So anyway, against that backdrop, i.e. the Havre's struggle for goals last season, not NBA players and their sons, against that backdrop, there was understandably a feeling heading into the campaign that the Havre would struggle to pick up points and that they would almost certainly be in and around the relegation zone. Now, there's clearly still a lot of football to be played between now and the end of the season, and they could absolutely still be dragged into a battle at the bottom, but so far they've given a really good account of themselves, Barlow. I do just briefly want to say a few words on the history of the club before we look at more recent developments. Now, some accounts say that Le Havre were founded in the 1870s, some accounts say that they were founded in the 1880s or even the 1890s, and quite simply, it's not very clear, certainly from what I was reading. In any event, we can comfortably say that they were founded towards the end of the 19th century, and we can comfortably say that they are one of the oldest clubs, if not the oldest club in French football. Fast forward a few decades, you then had the town of Le Havre being heavily bombed during the Second World War, with the area then being rebuilt almost completely according to the futuristic vision of Auguste Perret between 1945 and 1964. And during that period, the club enjoyed quite a bit of success. They did the double of sorts when they won the Ligue 2 title and the Coupe de France in 1959. And just by way of a further nugget of historical information, if you like, the club take their iconic dual sky blue and navy blue colours from Cambridge University and Oxford University, whose graduates founded the club as they moved across the Channel Sea from England to the north of France. So every day, Barlow, is a school day on the Road to Nowhere podcast. Anyway, when we take Le Havre's history, when we take their status as one of the oldest football clubs in France, and we couple it with the club's prestigious youth academy, which I'll come on to in a moment, I think we should, yeah, absolutely be showing them some love and giving them their flowers. Turning now to the club's youth academy, which I've just mentioned, the list of players who have come through Le Havre's youth system makes for really quite impressive reading. Now, bear with me here, Bill, because the list is quite extensive, but you've got Dimitri Payet, Paul Pogba, Felon Mondi, Riyad Mahrez, Steve Mondonda, Lassana Diarra, Mamadou Niang, Loic Badé, Isaac Touré, who we, of course, spoke about on our previous episode, Brice Samba, Olivier Ncham, Pap Gay, even the likes of cult heroes Charles Nzogbia and Foron Cinema Pongol. The list goes on. So yeah, quite an extensive list of academy graduates. And that is why we talk about this youth academy. Le Havre's youth academy is arguably one of the best in Europe. There's a really good interview in the Set Pieces with Michael Bunel, the technical director of the academy, who has worked with the club since 2005. He does come across, Barlow, as an unsung hero, and he seems to eat, sleep and breathe Le Havre, and you can tell that he's modest, but he's still really proud of the work he has done and continues to do for the club. So the interview is laced with some great quotes and some great insights. And to give you a flavour, Bunel says, quote, "We think that in order to become a top player, you have to be smart. Our philosophy is mainly based around developing the capacity of the player to be smart. When you look at the top players, they have the capacity to analyse what goes on around them and to make the right call, regardless of system, coach or style of play," unquote. He also, Barlow, talks about the importance of the player's maturity, the player's emotional intelligence, if you like, and he uses the example of Riyad Mahrez when talking about that. So Mahrez joined the club when he was 17 and he lived just 3 hours away from the club's base. I say just, it's quite a distance, especially when you're only 17. But because he was so mature, the club, regardless of the distance between where Mahrez was staying and the base, the club decided, yeah, he was a good fit. Bunel also emphasises the educational side of things. So he says, quote, "The boys, when they are 14 or 15, they go to school from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., after which they have a training session from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. and then they're asked to do their homework just before dinner. After dinner, they've got an hour free for their own activities. For the older ones, there are often two sessions a day. For instance, on Tuesdays, they're in school from 8 till 10 and then a session from 10:30 to 12. And then they go back to school before having another session at the end of the afternoon from 4 till 6. Everything is organised accordingly, unquote. So, yeah, quite extensive quotes there, but I felt like they did add to the section just to give people an insight into, yeah, why the Academy is so successful and how the Academy operates, the philosophy, I suppose, behind the Academy. So if you are looking for some additional reading, do go and check out that interview on the Set Pieces website with Mikael Bunel. It's written by Karan Tijwani, and yeah, it's a great read, Burl. The club's captain, 21-year-old Academy graduate Aruna Sangante, represents a nice link between the youth setup and the first team squad. So he's a central defender who started 35 of the 38 games last season in a solid defence that conceded just 19 league goals across the whole campaign. He made his debut for the first team aged 18 way back in January 2021 against Paris FC. I think that was in the cup, if I'm remembering correctly. And he's gone from strength to strength since then. So Sangante's underlying numbers, they're not too spectacular, but he does sit in the 99th percentile for interceptions. And in any event, Barlow, yeah, he's been a key feature of Le Havre's defence in Ligue 1 this season alongside Gauthier Lloris, who coincidentally is the brother of Hugo Lloris, who will get a second mention later on in this section. I don't think you would have envisaged two mentions for Hugo Lloris when you heard we're talking about Le Havre, but here we are. Elsewhere in the first team, I really like Loic Nego, the veteran Hungarian international who has already provided a couple of assists from out on the right. And he's one of these players, Bill, you can just tell when you watch him that he's having a lot of fun dancing down that wing and, almost making a fool out of opposition defenders. In the middle of the park, Daler Kushayev brings real grit and guile, as well as a wealth of Europa League and Champions League experience from his time with Zenit St. Petersburg. And then up top, Mohamed Bayo, a real cult hero, I suppose, on the Road to Nowhere podcast. He is on the road to redemption on loan from Lille, where he had, of course, been in the bad books for going out clubbing the night before the 7-1 loss at home to PSG at the start of last season. Bayo was, he was eased into the first team following his summer move, but we're seeing signs now of the player that did so well for his formative club, Clermont Foot, and he actually scored, I think it was his first goal for Le Havre against Clermont Foot, and let me tell you, Burl, he did not hold back. You might have forgiven him for, giving it the old hands-up gesture, not celebrating against his former team, but whilst it wasn't quite Emmanuel Adebayor against Arsenal levels, it was still quite a passionate celebration. The man in the dugout is Luca Elsner, who has been on something of a managerial pilgrimage over the last decade or so. And he's just, another layer to this quite fascinating club, actually. The more I read about them, Barlow, I was aware before I started my research that they were interesting, but the more I read about them, the more interesting a club they became to me. So talking about Luca Elsner, he started out by spending 3.5 years or so with Domžale in his country of birth, Slovenia, first as an assistant and then as the main man. He then had a brief spell in charge of NK Olimpia Ljubljana in the Slovenian capital before a forgettable stint in Cyprus at Paphos. After that, he caught the eye with a promising year in charge of Union Saint-Gilloise in Belgium, at the end of which Amiens, who were at that point in Ligue 1, came calling. Amiens were, however, relegated rather unfortunately when the Ligue 1 season was cut short due to the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm not sure if you remember that, Barlow, but it was all rather unfortunate, but it did open the door for Franck Eze and Lens to benefit. But anyway, that's another story, I suppose. And after Amiens were relegated because of that premature end to the season, Elsner parted company with the club a few games into the following campaign. That spell at Amiens did, however, allow him to cross paths with Matthew Bodmer, who was part of Elsner's playing squad and who would go on to become Le Havre's sporting director a couple of years later, and who would go on to connect with Elsner and bring him in, or rather be one of the decision makers, you would imagine, who was behind the thinking to bring in Luca Elsner. So after he parts company with Amiens, he then went back to Belgium where he took charge of Kortrijk and Standard Liège, and Standard Liège, his assistant manager was a certain Will Still, who is, of course, now at Rennes. That then brings us to June 2022 when the decision makers at Le Havre, including the aforementioned Matthew Bodmer, I think he was in position by the time they appointed Elsner. Could be wrong on that one, but I'm pretty sure he was in position by that time. Anyway, the decision makers brought in Luca Elsner. They handed him the managerial gig with the club still in League Two. And just again, as an aside, there's been quite a lot of nuggets of trivia in this section, Barlow, but Elsner's predecessor at Le Havre was none other than Paul Le Guin, who most likely won't be remembered too fondly by any Rangers fans who listen to the podcast. I was quite surprised when I realised that he was still managing as recently as that. And I think he had another job after Le Havre, so still kicking a ball, as they say, or still coaching folks to kick a ball. But anyway, in the space of 10 years or so, Elsner has evidently accrued a lot of experience, and he's had the chance to observe a lot of different approaches to football. He's had the chance as well, Barlow, to make mistakes, to get things wrong, and Le Havre are fully benefiting from that. Elsner's Amiens were synonymous, Barlow, with open and attacking football that was entertaining but rather naive in the sense that it left them quite vulnerable defensively, and it didn't ultimately produce the results to keep them in the top flight. There was a 4-4 draw with PSG in February 2020, which in a way was Amiens under Elsner in microcosm. Elsner's Le Havre, on the other hand, are a lot more solid defensively, as we noted earlier in the section. While they maybe don't score a huge amount of goals, there is still an end product there. The attacking players still have license to create, and that gives Le Havre, on the whole, a good amount of balance. Certainly a lot more balance than we saw with Elsner's Amiens. And clearly, based on Le Havre's League 2 title last season and their solid start to the current campaign, Elsner's coaching is working. It's paying off for Le Havre. The official Ligue 1 website actually did a great interview with Elsner in which he talks about his admiration for the defensive mentality of Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid. I think we'll come on to discuss Diego Simeone later in this episode. Elsner also talks about how he was inspired by Mauricio Pochettino and the humanity of his connection with the players, having spent a few days observing Pochettino when he was in charge at Spurs. Now, for what it's worth, Elsner and his younger brother actually grew up in Nice alongside, or rather with, Hugo Lloris. I said we would give him another mention, so here we are. So Elsner and Hugo Lloris grew up together, and Lloris was, of course, a key figure for Pochettino's Spurs side. So I did wonder, reading between the lines, if perhaps Lloris had connected Elsner with Pochettino. Maybe there was already a relationship there, I'm not sure, but it would make sense, Barlow. Turning back to Elsner's interview with the league and website, there's a great quote which encapsulates what he's doing or trying to do with Le Havre. He says, quote, "I've learned to be very flexible in my game model. I've made mistakes at some points when we wanted to show good football, and strategically the opponent was ready for that. We definitely don't want to be naive. It's nice to look like a cool team, but it could be 2 or 3 nil to the opponent. So that's what I want to prevent. We have to be good on many levels, but we don't want to be boring," unquote. Looking very briefly now to the future, Barlow, I really hope we'll get to see more first team action for the 18-year-old forward Steve Ngoura. Now, he's another product of the club's youth academy, and he caught the eye when he scored a hat-trick for France under-19s against Switzerland in a friendly last month. Now, he's only featured once for Le Havre's first team, making a very brief appearance in August last year, and he's still clearly very raw. That said, when you watch him play, you can see he has all the makings of a great centre-forward. There's a good thread on Twitter, actually, which talks about how he scores goals of all types, how he holds the ball up really well, how he works tirelessly, gets himself into good areas, and how he creates for others. And perhaps most importantly of all, at Le Havre, he's in a great place for his overall development. So, definitely one to watch, Barlow. On a closing note, survival in itself would be a huge achievement for Le Havre this season. They're a great club, one with a terrific history and one that really values its players' development with a real focus on the data as well. Over and above all of that, Barlow, Pete Doherty from the Libertines even has a soft spot for them. He told L'Équipe that he was one of the supporters actually who invaded the pitch at the end of the game against Dijon last season when Le Havre won promotion to League. And I think that is just a wonderful little anecdote with which to end our deep dive into all things Le Havre. After the international break, they travel to Nantes and Strasbourg, either side of a home clash with PSG. So let's see if they can build on their solid start to the campaign. Okie dokie, we are going to wrap up our analysis of Le Havre there. We'll come back very briefly to look at Spain.
We've kept Michael Jones under wraps as our super sub. Now that we have five subs, we can afford to be a bit more frivolous with our impact players. And Michael has been waiting patiently to come on, but he is with us now. How are you doing, Michael?
Yeah, I'm okay, apart from being left in a Zoom lobby for 15 minutes. No, I'm joking. I'm unable to record a bit earlier, but yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm excited to tune into the other bits a bit later, but it is getting very chilly here. What about you, Barlo?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Hectic as ever. I'm glad that there's an international break to cushion my landing this week. And apologies if listeners are subjected to the sound of howling dogs in the background. I am not responsible for those dogs. But I wouldn't feel too sorry for Michael, who... I am under good information, reliable sources that he is having his dinner made for him. So that's, we can't feel too sorry for him. But yeah, we'll get Spain kicked off then, shall we, Michael?
Yeah, well, I hope those dogs are being fed. But back to club football anyway. And we started off the season wondering whether Marcelino might mount a title challenge in France, and it now appears we might end it assessing whether he might mount a run to Europe in Spain. Villarreal have appointed their former manager back to the position until recently occupied by Pacheta, and there will be excitement in Castellón, Barlo.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Marcelino is arguably the greatest Villarreal manager ever after perhaps Manuel Pellegrini, and perhaps Unai Emery has his case now that he won the Europa League too. I mean, Marcelino came in 2013 with the side struggling in Segunda, got them promoted in second place, finished sixth twice off the back of that promotion, and then led them to a fourth place finish, their first jaunt into the Champions League kind of since those Pellegrini days. So he did have a major, major impact in his first spell with Villarreal. And as much as Marcelino had done some pretty good work before that job, I think that was the job that really cemented his place in the kind of upper echelon of Spanish managers, really announced his kind of presence to the world. And yeah, I mean, he picked up silverware in his following two jobs at Valencia and Athletic Club. So yeah, this is a successful manager. I've spoken pretty highly of him on the podcast in the past with regard to Marseille. Obviously, that came to a rather depressing end and a very early end. But it should be interesting for Villarreal, who are it's not the easiest place to come into right now. He initially left because he fell out with President Fernando Roche. I mean, they're both quite strong personalities, and he said in his kind of coming back press conference that it was due to both of them having too much ambition, which tells you that there was kind of disagreements over kind of what was to be done, how money was to be spent, I've no doubt. And I think that will be part of why I think that he has a chance of success here, because Pacheta's gone. I think it's 12 or 13 games he got at Villarreal. He was sacked after a defeat to a win over Maccabi Haifa, 2-1 win, but they were really struggling, and it was kind of at the last-ditch effort to win that game. And Villarreal, they've just not been convincing all season. And under Pacheta, we thought that perhaps they would get a bounce, because Pacheta is different to Quique Setién. He's less kind of set on one kind of way, one kind of style. He is much more of a motivational manager, much more dynamic, and very kind of... wherever he goes, his players seem to quite like him, but there was no reaction at all almost with Pacheta at the wheel. And the five wins that he had, only two of them were in La Liga, and they were against the bottom two sides in La Liga, which tells you, it partly explains why Villarreal are in 14th place and really struggling in La Liga this season. But I think the fact that Villarreal have been desperate for him to come in, the fact that he has this history with the Yellow Submarine, he has a very strong personality, and in some senses he's similar to Setién in that he also is kind of my way or the highway. He's also very idiosyncratic. He has kind of almost this militant kind of yeah reputation of measuring body fat, of really kind of pushing players hard. He's demanding not just of the players, but of the ownership too, of the people around him. He is going to really come in and crack the whip, I think. And I think that's part of the reason that Villarreal's situation almost helps him, because they are so desperate. The rumours are that he's got a deal for another couple of years. The rumours are that he's also been made promises in the transfer window. He has that kind of cult of personality behind him. He has that weight of many years of success behind him, in a way that Quique Setién, as much as he's always done well, Setién's reputation suffered quite a big blow at Barcelona. I think he lost the general kind of air of respect that most managers come in with. Pacheta, as much as he's very likable and he talks very well, he's very motivational, he doesn't have that weight of success behind him. Whereas Marcelino has the reputation, he has the power in the club, and the players that do not adhere to his ideas, the players that do not kind of respect what he wants to do, Marcelino has the power to get them out. Whereas previously, and we mentioned this before, Dani Parejo, Raúl Albiol, Pepe Reina, these veterans that had success with Villarreal were very much in the driving seat of what happened to Setién and what happened to Pacheta. So I think there's reasons to be excited. We've mentioned that he was successful at Athletic Club. He was successful at Valencia. He always tends to play really kind of vertical, high, intense, pressing football. It tends to be entertaining with him at the wheel. And as much as Villarreal still have holes in their squad, and he pointed out that this is not an easy job to come into necessarily, he said that he kind of blamed the players to a certain extent. He said that if there's been two managers, if I'm the third coming in, then it can't just be the manager that's the issue. So he's already kind of putting the microscope on the players and saying, you guys need to buck up your ideas too. But there is talent in this Villarreal squad. There's some good young players. I think there's still the basis of quite a lot of quality there. And even if I've been kind of advocating for perhaps a change of generation coming up for Villarreal, I mentioned Albiol, Reina, Parejo, they're in the twilight of their careers. Marcelino is probably the one who has the power to both do that if he wants to, or if these players buy into it, if they kind of back him and they kind of show their best version again, then perhaps the likes of Etienne Campeau can find their best form again. And they put in a pretty spirited performance against Atleti at the weekend. They lost 3-1, but put up a good fight with sporting director Miguel Angel Tena at the wheel. And yeah, I think Marcelino is going to get a reaction out of this side. If he didn't, then yeah, it's going to be pretty dire straits for Villarreal, but I think he will.
Yeah, well, speaking of managers who like to crack the whip, Diego Simeone has signed a deal last week to extend his stay at Atletico Madrid until 2027. If he fulfills that contract, he will have been in charge for over 15 years. So El Cholo is here to stay, and right now things are rosy at the Metropolitano Ballo.
Absolutely. I mean, Simeone was already in that echelon of managers with the likes of Arsene Wenger, with the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson, not because of necessarily his longevity, but because of the way he transformed this club. He took them into a different zone of the table. And even during an interview, he gave a very long kind of 90-minute interview with Karina Ser on the Monday nights, as we record on Tuesday. And even in that, he said that the fans are no longer content to win our league, as he termed it, which was with Valencia, with Betis, with Sevilla. We want to annoy people. We want to frustrate people. We want to kind of be in and amongst Barcelona and Real Madrid and cause them issues. And then, as he always says, if they fail, then we have to be there. We have to be the ones to kind of step in and take the glory. But it was good to listen to him, actually. He was a bit more relaxed and in an environment where he was a bit more kind of free to speak. He did answer some questions, I think, in his press conferences. And this is not a hit against Simeone, but he's perhaps more careful. He's more short with his answers. He's not necessarily willing to entertain things as much. But off the back of this renewal, off the back of the kind of euphoria that's come for an Atleti side that are playing really well, even if they've dropped a couple of silly points here and there. They got beaten by Las Palmas recently. There was that Valencia defeat. They beat Celtic 6-0 in pretty thrilling fashion against Villarreal. That was a good challenge for them. They went 1-0 down and responded with 3 goals. The likes of Samuel Lino is in frightening form. Griezmann, we know just how good he is, and there's talk of the Ballon d'Or in Spain for Griezmann at some point. Pablo Barrios, another young player coming through, is doing very well. Rodrigo Riquelme is now in the Spain squad. He looks fantastic. And yeah, he was pretty interesting in that interview. He was talking about Hannes Joao Felix and saying that, look, if you don't understand the culture somewhere, if you don't understand the idiosyncrasies, what you want from your players, or what the fans want from their players, then it's very hard for you to kind of survive and exist, and kind of saying no wonder that Leti didn't like him, because frankly he's just not our style of player. He was talking about kind of managers that he'd like to succeed him. He mentioned Pochettino, Klopp. He mentioned Carlo Ancelotti as well, which I'm sure brought a wry smile from many Real Madrid and Atleti fans. The two of them have a great mutual respect for each other, even if they're kind of polar opposites in many ways. And yeah, I think Simeone admitted on the Monday night that last season was his lowest moment as a manager, even though they've lost two Champions League finals in kind of extremis, one in extra time, one on penalties. Last season was when they were really not responding. At the World Cup, they were in fifth place. They really struggled and they looked kind of a shell of a football team. People were wondering, myself included, everyone, I think, in Spain, whether this was the end of the Simeone era, whether it would just be a good time to part ways. But now he looks reinforced. The whole of the Metropolitano is behind him. He's extended his contract until 2027. Griezmann is playing out of his skin. Some of the football that Atleti are playing is some of the best that I've seen them play in certainly a long time. And even in that title-winning season, Simeone said that we're playing similar football to the way that we did a couple of years ago. But that title-winning season, and the proof will be in the pudding this season as well, that was kind of half a season. They did really well for about 5-6 months, and then they fell off and they kind of survived until they could get over the line in La Liga. And now I think they're playing better football than that. I think the addition of Griezmann is making a big difference. The addition of Morata, who's in brilliant form, the best form of his career for me as well. Everything's just going right for Atleti. And even though they still have issues, even though they're conceding quite a lot of goals, which is, the antithesis of what we think of for Atleti, now they're just kind of blowing teams away. And so it feels fresh, it feels new, it feels kind of like a real new dawn for me at Atleti, even though we're talking about him perhaps going for 15 years. So yeah, positive signs at the Metropolitano.
Well, it's great to hear that they're playing better football as well, and I think it will warm them to a different set of neutrals. And speaking of good football in Spain, there are several sides impressing with their neat possession-based play in La Liga, including one former La Masia product, but it isn't Xavier Hernandez. Tell us about Las Palmas.
Yes, it's Francisco Javier García Pimienta. García Pimienta to most in the business and outside. And yeah, Jamie Kemp, who does work for Opta, he wrote a really good article about Alvaro Baez for Football España, and he was talking about kind of how he's one of the goalkeeping revelations of the season. He's been performing very well, but he had, went at the time of the writing of the article, he had 243 touches outside of the box through about 12 games. So that's over 20 touches a game outside the box. It was more than double anyone else, double the likes of kind of Kepa or Ter Stegen or anyone else. He was kind of really playing as the extra man and being brave. And Las Palmas are now 11 points clear of the relegation zone, which at this point in the season is kind of unbelievable, because I mean, they've one of the lowest budgets in La Liga. We've spoken a little bit before about how they lack a goal scorer. They don't really have one amongst their ranks, and they're kind of relying on getting goals from everywhere. But they're, even if they're still quite safe, they're playing some of the best football in the division. The fact that their captain, Jonathan Vieira, who's probably perhaps one of two or three of their most talented footballers, he kind of went AWOL. He went to Dubai thinking he was going to get a very big money move, but he seems to have agreed to stay now. But there's been kind of a falling out there. And the fact that García Pimienta has kind of ruled that out without it necessarily affecting the team, without the fans kind of questioning him too much, is a testament to just how stable he has things there. The likes of Julián Araujo, who's on loan for Barcelona, has been very good at right back. The fact that Mika Marmol comes in from Andorra in Segunda, and again, another former Barcelona product for a former La Masia coach. That's where he kind of cut his teeth. Mika Marmol has come in and looked really good in La Liga too. And further forward, the fact that Kylian Rodriguez, who is a brilliant story, he was suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma at the start of the season 2 seasons ago, and he had a long road to recovery, got back on the pitch in about February, I think it was, last season, and he recovered to kind of see them through to play, see them through to La Liga and get them promoted. And he's been amongst sort of the best in La Liga in terms of kind of progressive passes, statistics, receiving passes in the final third. He's been kind of really up there. A really exciting young talent in Alberto Maleiro, who scored a brilliant goal as well at the weekend. There's just a lot going right, and there's a lot to love about this Las Palmas side, that even though they do have kind of quite a few talented players, the likes of Marmol, obviously, formerly of Barcelona, Araujo, formerly of, or on loan from Barcelona, they've got kind of various kind of La Liga veterans and kind of journeymen. They're not blessed with loads of quality, but they fight pretty hard. There's a few good stories in there. They're really committed. It's a really good atmosphere in Gran Canaria. And right now it looks as if they're kind of nearly halfway to safety, and we're not nearly halfway through the season. So yeah, they're really starting to move. They're an interesting side to watch, an interesting case in general. And yeah, just give my hats off to Las Palmas and García Pimienta.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much, Barlow. Well, now we're going to metaphorically turn the tables, and Barlow is going to ask me a few things about Italy in our next section.
To me, at least, it felt somewhat inevitable. But after Napoli's 1-0 defeat to struggling Empoli, the wait for Rudy Garcia's dismissal in some ways has felt longer than his tenure. Doomed from the start, the Frenchman was handed the impossible task of trying to emulate Luciano Spalletti's Scudetto success last season. It's safe to say that the former Liga winning coach did not help himself, though. Did he, Michael?
Absolutely not. Yeah, I'm really torn on this one in terms of how I feel, whether it was the right decision or not. Yeah, it was the right decision to sack him, but whether he should have been given the job in the first place, again, I don't think he should have been given that. And like he was to say, it was inevitable. I don't think that's probably one of the least unique comments you've ever made on this podcast, Barlow. I think anybody from afar who
I'll
ever saw
that,
yeah, it's not a bad one to take it on. But I think anybody who saw that appointment from afar in the summer would have made exactly the same prediction. It's quite interesting. I've been listening to some feedback. I listened to the Italian football podcast yesterday even, and their response to it was along the lines of, you know, what normally when there's an appointment, no matter how bad or good it is, there is normally like a sliver of optimism surrounding it. And in this case, there didn't seem to be a good argument made by anybody as to what Rudy Garcia could do to maintain or improve this Napoli team, which for a team that's, you know, had this incredible first half of the year, an incredible last season where they won their first Scudetto since Diego Maradona played for them. It just screams of a club that almost feels out of its depth, and Aurelio De Laurentiis is really responsible for that, not just, you know, whether there was to what degree he's responsible for the departure of Luciano Spalletti. It was quite clear he did also say he wanted to be away from regular club football. He's now the Italy manager, but whether De Laurentiis could have done more to kept him, I think, is another argument to be had, and I think one that you could probably point some fingers at the Napoli chairman, but also whether the right decisions were made in the succession of that, and whether the right summer decisions were made, not just with the coaching staff, but also with the playing staff as well. And Rudy Garcia, he'd arrived, you know, following this underwhelming spell with Al Nassr in Saudi Arabia, where he'd already proven himself not to be working too well with some of the key figures, Cristiano Ronaldo in particular, but also Anderson Talisca there as well. And Napoli's success, as much as it was a team and coaching effort, it was led by two real stars and breakout stars in European football, in Victor Osimhen and Carucci Carrara at Scalia. Breakout, I guess, differing degrees. And what we've seen this season, I mean, Osimhen's goals to game record hasn't actually been that bad. He's scored 6 goals in 8 games. But Kvaratskhelia is, although he's trying all the same things that he did last season, there just doesn't seem to be anywhere near the same conviction that he's had in it. And although he's tried to adopt this similar formation of Spalletti using a 4-3-3, recent games against Union Berlin when they drew 1-1 in the Champions League, which, you know, 5 months ago probably doesn't sound a terrible result or bad result, but given Union Berlin's exploits in Germany this season and in Europe, it's quite a poor result from a Napoli perspective, especially, you know, these are results that you can overlook, but not when a manager's under pressure. And I think that was also the case with this Empoli game, where they had a few shots from distance, didn't really trouble the goalkeeper too much, and then Kvaratskhelia created something from nothing, albeit it was a shot at the near post in the closing minutes of the game before Empoli went up the other end and scored the winner in additional time, where there was just very little pressure on from the defenders on him. And I think that's been one of the problems as well. They've not, in the ways that Garcia hasn't been helped, in the way that De Laurentiis is to blame for this, you know, I mentioned Simeone's absence. They lost Kim Min-jae, who was huge to that success now at Bayern Munich. But the players that came in to replace them, again, just felt utterly underwhelming. Nathan, player I didn't know loads about arriving from Brazil, he's not being trusted to be a regular starter. He's had some okay performances, but he's been marred by inconsistency, which is only natural for a player coming, making that kind of transition. But to be joining a team at this level and expected to fill the void left by Kim Min-jae is, you know, absolutely bizarre recruitment and completely unfair on the player coming in, unless he is a generational talent, which very few players prove to be. And Leo Østergaard, a player I'd seen in England way before coming to Italy, and a player he'd struggled in his time at Genoa as well before Napoli, has somehow sort of danced his way into the Napoli defence. And another player who's just not really been convincing in that role, playing next to Amir Romani, who I think certainly benefited from playing next to a centre-back as capable as Kim Min-jae. But I guess it also points to, you know, I know Østergaard wasn't a new signing, but Nathan was, but it also points to other new signings who just haven't been trusted by Rudy Garcia. The likes of Jens Kajusta, Swedish midfielder, who was at Stade Reims last season. He's only made 2 starts. Jesper Lindstrom, who ran from Eintracht Frankfurt, one of the most exciting talents in the Bundesliga over the last few years, crucial to them winning the Europa League a couple of years ago. He's only made 1 start. Since joining, he's made 7 appearances, no goals or assists. And he did have a relatively decent chance against Empoli at the weekend. But, you know, in his case, it felt too little too late. And I think in Rudy Garcia's case, it's just felt a little bit too little too late. He's not been able to galvanize those key figures, and he's not really been able to get more or implement the new signing so that they're able to perform anywhere near the levels that were set by them at this point a year ago when they looked one of the best teams in Europe. Whether things are going to get better for Napoli looks to be a completely separate debate now, apart from De Laurentiis will be entirely responsible for this. Also, it looked like Igor Tudor was going to be initially appointed another manager, another former Marseille manager. That looks like it's not happening now. I'm sure people have a much clearer picture by the time the podcast comes out, but he wanted a contract up until the end of 2025, which they're not looking for a long-term fix. So Walter Mazzarri, who had success with Napoli over a decade ago, he has returned to the fold. But if you follow his managerial career since then, it's been a poor stint at Inter Milan. The following season, 2-year hiatus, struggled at Watford after a season he was sacked. Okay, not the worst thing to happen to any manager, before underwhelming spells in Italy as well. And De Laurentiis has been set on keeping his 4-3-3 formation, but Mazzarri has built most of his success off playing 3-5-2. So whether that's maybe identifying those centre-back weaknesses, that could be one positive even to it, that they will be a bit more solid at the back. But I think the main problems for Napoli have been that creativity and clinicality in the way, you know, especially following Victor Osimhen's departure. And Walter Mazzarri, a defence-first coach, doesn't exactly inspire the confidence needed for Napoli to pick up with this. And they don't just risk now fallen off from being short-term title challengers, which I think should be the aspiration for any team that's just won the title. They almost look like they could regress to the point of where they were with Gattuso, Gennaro Gattuso before Spalletti, where they're a team struggling on the periphery of European football, not just Champions League football, but Europa League and Europa Conference League football. And this could be a really ill-fated appointment. It could be proven wrong. It could at least provide some stability. But it's been a really sad few months for Napoli after something that was built so wonderfully, largely to the credit of Luciano Spalletti.
Yes, Spalletti off to work his wonders at Italy, hopefully for the Azzurri. Napoli will be looking up to Juventus in the table, much to their chagrin, who have been getting on quietly but effectively with their business, winning 5 league games on the spin. Ahead of their biggest challenge yet at home to Inter Milan, who are 2 points ahead, Max Allegri might not be forming the most beautiful team on the eye, but the Bianconeri are returning to their well-oiled winning ways. Tell us, how has Allegri been achieving that?
Yeah, the most consistent team in Italy. And I think it depends what you think beauty on the eye consists of, because it could be that, you know, like we talked about, that kind of football under Diego Simeone at Atletico Madrid. Okay, Juventus are not offering that. And there doesn't seem to be the real signs that Allegri's kind of transforming Juventus into that team at the moment. If you like sort of traditional backs against the wall, scraping results football, and you see the beauty in that, then this is certainly the football for you. If you also see the football or the beauty in football in bizarre and funny moments on the pitch, then currently Juventus are also the team for you also, because their 2-1 win over Cagliari, their second goal before we go any further, is one of the most unique goals I've seen this season, probably a bit further as well. Daniele Regani, who has re-established himself at the back of this Juventus defence, which I'll come on to very shortly, he has managed to score a goal that's come into him for a cross by thrusting his hips at the ball, connecting with the ball so it hits the crossbar, and then only coming back to his hips to thrust at the ball again to send it over the line, which led to a lengthy VAR check, I think, mainly because of the pure manner of the goal. But it was another victory for Juventus. They did concede. I think you mentioned Barlow. They did concede. It was the first goal they'd actually conceded in 5 games. And that has been a big key to the success of Juventus in recent weeks. And I think people generally, you know, if you take out Massimiliano Allegri's credentials for one moment, and you know, the multiple Serie A's he's won, both with Juventus and the single one he won with AC Milan, if you take out Allegri's coaching credentials for 1 minute and you look at this Juventus squad compared to teams, the starting lineups of the last decade or so, this is such a weak and uninspiring Juventus squad on paper. And in spite of that, Allegri's managed to really galvanise a winning team, a team that know exactly what they're doing, a team that are modest and appreciative in their capabilities and what they are able to do in a football match. You aren't seeing them going out in the same sense that Inter Milan are going and trying to blow teams away, trying to outmanoeuvre them and to outplay them. Juventus certainly haven't done that, especially in a recent game against Fiorentina where they scored a wonderful early goal, but then went on to sit back for most of the game. But yeah, instead of that, they've been resilient, resolute, and we're also seeing the emergence of quite a number of young Italian players, which has been really refreshing to see. And you know, in the area where we've seen the departures of Bonucci and Giorgio Chiellini in the summer, we're now seeing the emergence of a new generation of potential Italian Juventus stars. Federico Gatti's played on the right side of a back three. He's been fantastic for them. Fabio Moretti in midfield. Everybody will know about the enforced absences of Paul Pogba, which has been, you know, that's their real star player that they probably have within their ranks at the moment. He's got his drugs ban, and Nico Fagioli, player we talked a lot about on the podcast, he's been in the news recently and has now been banned for his involvement in a gambling scandal, which I guess just kind of adds the heritage to this kind of Juventus team right now. But Moretti's come in, he scored that goal versus Fiorentina. Andrea Cambiasso, flying fullback, has also been a real bright spark for them. And then up front, Moise Kean, who I think has been written off a number of times in his career, just got the player of the month in Serie A, despite scoring no goals. But his fruitful relationship with Federico Chiesa up top has just been really, really good to see. And it's been such an effective tool for Juventus on the counter-attack, and one I think they'll have a lot of confidence in using against Inter Milan. And as I was saying, there's this real sense with this Juventus team that they sort of know the restrictions, they know the limits, but they don't have the distractions of European football, despite, you know, league position wise at least qualifying for it last season, but due to the point deductions and the ban from Europe meaning that they didn't qualify for any of them, so they've not had that distraction. And it does remind you a little bit of when Antonio Conte galvanised a bit of a winning team in, I think it was the 2011-12 season, his first title Scudetto victory with Juventus. I think there's real similarities and parallels between the two. The only thing I'd say, sort of, this is going to be a good test of where they are against Inter Milan. It will be, because Inter Milan are only 2 points above them, and it could be a really key fixture in the outcome of the league this season. But given how much I think Juventus are overperforming in terms of results, at least, I think we can look past the aspect or the argument that we can expect them to play good football, because I'm not sure that they ever truly will under Allegri. It's just not the way that his teams have been bred to play or trained to play. But, you know, Inter Milan's best results this season have come against teams who have looked to have the ball against them. You know, they won all eight games against the teams who have had the most possession against them. Juventus aren't going to offer that. They had 34% against Fiorentina, I think 36%, or maybe 36 and 38 against Lazio and Fiorentina, where they pulled off two of the best results of the season. They defeated Lazio 3-1, which is when they conceded the last goal, but they've also defeated AC Milan recently 1-0. That was their third lowest, but that was a 48% possession they had in that game. But they are happy to relinquish possession in this game, and it's going to be such an intriguing test for both the credibilities of this Inter Milan team, who've been getting the plaudits for all the right reasons this season, and Juventus, who from a purist view, you could say maybe getting applauded for the wrong reasons, in that it's solely for results. But I think there's something a bit more special laying beneath the surface with this Bianconeri side.
Fascinating stuff. And we finish off with a firecracker, a Rome derby, which, after a 0-0 draw, had more action off the pitch than it did in the Stadio Olimpico. Lazio's inconsistency and struggles in front of goal have been a regular theme this season against their rivals, who they defeated last season. Many people expected Maurizio Sarri's side to progress this term, including yourself, Michael. Why then has that not been the case so far?
Yeah, well, I think including the fixture against Roma, I don't think they've had the easiest run of fixtures. And I'll come on to that in a bit, because that's quite an easy defence for Lazio. Nevertheless, there's still been a very underwhelming aspect to them. Despite only being 4 points off Europe, off the top four, actually, this season, they still find themselves 10th in Serie A. And yeah, they have been really underwhelming so far. They finished last season a really impressive second in Sarri's first season. And I was one of those who thought that Lazio might be a real underdog, maybe in the sense that Napoli were under Spalletti to kick on and challenge for the league this season. That already is starting to look out of reach. They're 10 points from the summit from Inter Milan, and I don't think there's any real chance that we're going to see a comeback from them soon. And I think the departure of Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, just to put another big reason out there, I thought they maybe dealt with that better than they did. And in fact, maybe it's more resembling of when Gareth Bale left Tottenham to go to Real Madrid, and they brought an influx of what looked very eye-catching, intriguing signings, the likes of Paulinho, Eric Lamella, trying to think of other ones now, but who, you know, very good players in their own right, but were just not fit for the project at the time. And I certainly hope that isn't the case for Lazio, because I think some of the signings that they made this summer were really eye-catching and really exciting, and young players with a point to prove, which I don't think so many of the big clubs in Italy have used as a transfer or recruitment strategy in the past few years. But I think Sarri, in his comments, which will probably also be a welcome distraction, his sort of ongoing feud with Jose Mourinho, I mean, in fairness to that, Sarri did say about Mourinho that, you know, he seems to be a really nice guy away from football, but the media Mourinho he absolutely detests. And I think a lot of people can probably relate to that. But going back to the point of sort of Sarri and his comments around the game, you know, Roma had a couple of good chances. Roma had a goal disallowed, but it was a pretty blunt game, like you said. And Sarri said at that point, given what was on the line and given the teams aren't exactly, neither team are flying high in confidence at the moment, it was just important that they didn't lose. And there is probably quite a large element of truth in that. And I think they've gone about their season quite pragmatically so far, quite similar to Maurizio Sarri's sort of second half of the season when he at Chelsea, when he guided them to the Europa League victory. I don't think they that Sarri ball that people were really hoping and expecting to see from him ever really came to the fore. But yeah, what we've seen other than that has been a team that have been plugging away in the Champions League and been challenging Atletico Madrid. Obviously, Provedel scored that famous the goalkeeper Ivan Provedel scored that famous last minute equaliser in the opening Champions League group game. They've since done the double over Celtic and lost against Feyenoord, but you know they're currently sitting second in the group and looking in a healthy position to qualify there. So it's certainly not all doom and gloom for Lazio at the moment. I'd say similar to what we were talking about with Napoli, there's a few new players who I don't think have maybe started or featured in as many games as well. Matteo Guendouzi was a bright spark in that draw against Roma. He's only started 7 games so far this season. Nico Ravella, really exciting 21-year-old Italian player we talked about at the start of the season as our breakout star. He's only started 6 games so far this season. Valentin Castellanos, is that how you say it? You can maybe help me out there, Barlow.
Tati Castellanos to his friends and people like me.
Yeah, well, and he, thank you very much. And he had a great season in Spain last season. Again, this was meant to be a real sort of statement move, both for that ownership model in Spain, but also for Lazio in maybe looking to the future ahead of Jerome Mobley. And there's certainly a lot of time for Castellanos to turn that around, but he's only scored 1 goal, but he's only been given 5 starts and very much only when Immobile's not been available. And Daichi Kamada, another player we talked about, these sort of exciting Frankfurt players who just don't seem to be offered the opportunity. Maybe both of them would have been better at staying in Frankfurt off early evidence. He's got a goal and an assist, but he's only started 4 games and made another 6 appearances off the bench and is one of the lowest minute holders in the squad. And the same could be said for Isaacs and a winger brought in from Denmark. So whether Sarri's actually got enough trust for these players and maybe he's going out too much, not enough ambition at the moment, could be said. But I think looking ahead to the games all the way until the end of January, the only team that got to play in the top 10 now are Inter Milan. So I think once they get the distraction of the Champions League, and not that it is a formality by any means, they've got the toughest 2 games to go in final at Atletico Madrid, but they can get through that group and start to focus more on the league again. They have a real opportunity to pick up points. And, you know, Napoli are currently sitting around the top 4. It looks like they could be due even more of a fall off if anything that I said about Mazzarri is true, which, you know, knowing me, probably not. But there is the opportunity for Lazio to really climb the table over the next 10 to 12 games. And Sarri can put some winning form together like he did last season. Bear in mind, they've won their last 3 games before the last 2 where they've lost and drawn. So there is signs that Sarri is able to build some form in this Lazio team. And I'm still optimistic that they can still be challenging for the Champions League places.
Yes, hopefully so. And yes, I always do like the kind of variety of competition in Serie A. So a good one to keep an eye on. We're going to take a short but sweet break here. And we'll be back with Deutschland and Der Klassiker afterwards, Bayern against Dortmund. In Deutschland, all eyes were on Thomas Tuchel's Bayern Munich as they travelled to Dortmund for the most recent edition of Der Klassiker. The clash came only a matter of days after Bayern's shock DFB Pokal defeat against third-tier Saarbrücken, and rather naively, hopes were therefore high that Borussia Dortmund could register just a 3rd league win over their Bavarian rivals since 2014. Those hopes were, however, quite decidedly dashed as a Harry Kane-inspired Bayern romped to a 4-0 victory. So, Ali, what did the game tell us about where Dortmund and Bayern are right now?
Yeah, but I had hoped to have friend of the podcast, Byron Hutchison, on for this section to chat us through the game. Byron, of course, works for the Bundesliga, and he was actually pitch side, much like you were, Barlow, for the Atletico Madrid Celtic game. Byron was actually pitch side for Dia Clásica, and having seen some of his photos, some of his videos from that game, it looked like a fantastic experience. But Byron is a busy man and he was unavailable this evening, so we'll try and get him on at some point this season. But for this section, for this episode, you're just going to have to make do with my thoughts on the game, which probably won't be anywhere near as nuanced as those of our good friend Byron. But yeah, I think coming into this game, Barlow, there was an expectation, perhaps, that Dortmund could get something out of this. You obviously had Bayern losing to Saarbrücken. You had Dortmund, who admittedly haven't been great this season, but they had produced a winning performance against Newcastle in the Champions League at St James's Park. So you would have imagined that coming into this one, expectations, hopes would have been high that Dortmund could have recorded a win here, that they could have got one over Bayern Munich. But as you say, yeah, a Harry Kane-inspired Bayern prevailed, and very quickly it became very apparent that this was going to be just a foregone conclusion. You had Bayern 2-0 up within 10 minutes. And what I think it tells us more about Dortmund this game than it tells us about Bayern Munich. But what it tells us about Dortmund is that perhaps we really need to lower our expectations. We were saying before we came on here, Barlow, that with Dortmund, so often it is the ill-founded hope that kills you. It's that hope that really you have no right to have that does kill you. And I think we saw it on the last game of the season when they had their own fate in their own hands and they managed to mess it up there. And again, coming into this one, you know, they were in a good place. Bayern seemingly weren't in the best of places, and yet they still looked so feeble. They still looked so poor. And the game was, quite disappointing as a result. I mean, Bayern, for what it's worth, probably produced their best performance of the season, arguably their best performance under Thomas Tuchel, full stop. And I think what we saw, I think Andy Brassel described it as a backlash or a revenge mission of sorts. But what we saw was an angry Bayern Munich off the back of that embarrassing defeat against Saarbrücken. We saw them produce a quite fantastic performance, very clinical, particularly in that first half. In the second half, it wasn't quite as ruthless, shall we say, but in that first half I thought they were fantastic. Had it not been for Gregor Kobel and the Borussia Dortmund goal, it could have been a lot more than four. And I think it just exposed a lot of the flaws in this Borussia Dortmund side. I think Edin Terzic is but one of several coaches who have tried and failed to emulate what Jurgen Klopp was able to do at Dortmund. The squad has had good players. You obviously had Jude Bellingham, you had Erling Haaland, but on the whole, the squad has always felt not quite good enough to sustain a proper title challenge over the course of the season. Obviously, last season they did manage that, and that in itself was a very solid achievement. But the squad, mentally and just in terms of ability as well, it doesn't seem like it's in the right place to, over the course of a full season, challenge Bayern Munich. If you're going to sustain a title challenge over the course of a season and you're going to keep up with Bayern Munich, you almost need to be not quite flawless, but you need to be able to capitalise on Bayern's weak moments, on Bayern's vulnerability. And they were in a weak moment, they were in a weak position after that defeat against Saarbrücken. And Barlow, you maybe have heard this, but there were murmurings coming from the Bayern camp that it wasn't quite the happiest of camps, that players were starting to query what it was Thomas Tuchel was actually trying to do. At least with Nagelsmann, there was a clear philosophy there. But with Tuchel, I think some of the players were starting to second guess, I suppose, what Tuchel was trying to do. And you would have been struggling to see signs at all that was the case with the performance against Borussia Dortmund. And I think, on the one hand, you have to ask questions of Borussia Dortmund. But on the other hand, I think you have to say fair play to Bayern Munich. They produced an excellent performance. And certainly for the time being anyway, they've allayed fears that all is not well with Thomas Tuchel and his camp in Bavaria. Barlow, I'm quite keen to hear from you as well, actually, on how the game itself was perceived in the Spanish media and how, maybe to an extent, Borussia Dortmund and their perennial failures, their perennial shortcomings are perceived in the Spanish media.
Yeah, a lot of the attention in Spain was, I think, kind of on Harry Kane, because while Real Madrid then did go and beat Valencia 5-1 at the weekend. In general, it's been a struggle up front for Los Blancos, and Harry Kane was obviously the alternative name that was proposed apart from Kylian Mbappe. And seeing Kane and his dramatic impact at Bayern has really left some Madridistas, I think, looking enviously on at Kane, despite Bellingham's kind of good goal-scoring start. I think with Dortmund, they're not quite seen in the same echelon. And from a kind of more personal point of view, whenever I watch the Clásico or whenever I kind of tune in for the highlights and stuff, it always astounds me just kind of the ease of goal that Bayern seem to end up scoring against them. And this is very much kind of an outside perspective. As I say, this is not somebody that's covering both teams or either team very closely, but it does seem like kind of a mental thing to me. Because if you look at the hat-trick that Kane scores, all of them are dead simple chances, and he doesn't have to work for those goals. He doesn't have to produce any brilliance. And it always seems as if Dortmund tend to give up an early goal or a goal in the first half that sets them on the back foot. And yeah, for me, I think they need to have kind of a clear enough identity that they can go into these games and really make Bayern work for these wins. Because far too often, from my point of view, it seems as if Bayern kind of really early on will punch them in the mouth and then kind of cruise home to an easy win. So yeah, from that point of view, I think Dortmund, they just always seem like a tier below, whereas 6-7 years ago, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, Paul, it does feel a bit like Groundhog Day when you watch Der Klassiker these days. It does feel like you sometimes get your hopes up, but yeah, more often than not, those hopes are very quickly dashed. And it's a shame because it should be the headline fixture. I mean, to an extent, it still is the headline fixture in the Bundesliga calendar. It should be a game that we look forward to more than perhaps we now do. But because of the nature of the last 10 years or so of the fixture, maybe not quite stretching back as far as that, but certainly over the last few years, it's been almost too predictable that Bayern will turn up, that Dortmund won't turn up, and that Bayern will walk all over them. And I think that in itself must be quite frustrating for Dortmund fans, over and above all the other causes for frustration at the Signal Iduna Park. But on the one hand, I suppose they have just managed back-to-back wins over Newcastle United in the Champions League. They are now, as a result of those wins, in a rather pretty position ahead of the final two games of the Champions League group stages. And so I suppose that in itself is cause for relative optimism. Yeah, I think we do need to monitor how the two teams progress over the course of the season. I can probably say without any hesitation that Bayern will be the winners of the league, the Bundesliga champions, come the end of the season. But as we've said plenty of times on this podcast, Barlow, the real storylines, the real narratives, in terms of the most interesting ones anyway, those are to be found elsewhere, lower down the Bundesliga table. Okay, Barlow, I think with that, we will draw the episode to a close. I'll thank you. I'll thank Michael Jones. We've had to perform some podcast gymnastics this evening, to use a favourite term. And we've hopefully produced for you, the listener, another entertaining hour or so of European football analysis. Thank you for your time, Rudy Barlow. And thank you to you, the listener, for your continued support. See you in another fortnight. Until then, stay safe, stay well. Goodbye.